I'm delighted to be here and to introduce two very special people tonight who are writers for children. And we know that greater attention is being paid now to children's writing than ever before. The inclusion of Harry Potter in the main Whitbread Awards this year shows us that children's writing has indeed got a key place in the world of literature. And judging by the number of adults who appear to be enjoying the Harry Potter series, it's interesting to speculate whether the boundaries between children's literature and adult literature are drawing closer or are in fact perhaps disappearing. What we have to recognise is that children's books are now studied critically by adults at several universities in the UK, including Warwick, and research into children's literature is now a recognised academic field. So what does it mean to be a writer of books for children as we go into the new century? And to help us explore some of these ideas, we have two of the best known and best loved writers with us here. They've both been writing for children for over 20 years, and though their work is in many ways, I think, quite different, they nevertheless hold important features in common. Both of them are supreme storytellers who know how to communicate directly with young readers through their writing. That's the first thing. The second thing is that both of them understand that modern children live in complex social worlds, and they're not afraid to engage with their young readers at a deeper level and to deal with difficult ideas. Michael Rosen, probably occupies a unique place in the world of children's literature as a writer, poet, broadcaster, academic, and editor. And a second generation of children are enjoying his poems and stories both at home and at school, and he's rightly become a household name. Just to give you an example, today I was marking an exam question which looked at the assessment of children's writing in school. And the question goes something like this. You don't make a pig fatter by weighing it regularly, so why is regular assessment of pupils' writing considered important? And the student answered, showing a pig that it is 4 pounds heavier than last week will not make it eat more, but show a pupil that their writing is similar to Michael Rosen's verse will inspire them to write more. And strange, I just read that this afternoon. And books such as Hairy Tales and Nursery Crimes, You Can't Catch Me, Don't Put Mustard in the Custard, Mind Your Own Business, Quick, Let's Get Out of Here. Michael's new one, which he's just shown me, called Centrally Heated Knickers, are all part of that tradition. Indeed, one version of Down Behind the Dustbin has achieved immortality by becoming a taboo playground rhyme in at least one Coventry playground. And that, I think, is part of children's willingness to subvert. And I can't think of any higher acclaim for a writer than to become part of the traditional lore and language of school children. Last year, Michael received awards in two categories from Books for Keeps. The readership voted him the outstanding 20th century children's poet, beating Ted Hughes and Roger McGough into second and third places, and they voted him the favourite 20th century children's poet, beating Roger McGough and Charles Causley into second and third places. Gillian Cross has also won great acclaim for her children's books. Way back in 1982, The Dark Behind the Curtain was highly commended for the Carnegie Medal and shortlisted the following year for the Guardian Children's Fiction Award. In 1984, On the Edge was shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal and for the Whitbread. In 1986, Chartbreak was shortlisted for the Carnegie. And in 1990, Wolf won the Carnegie Medal. And that's a book that Margaret Meek describes as a splendid, daring book exploring mind and nature and mind in society, a book that makes nonsense of the fact-fiction divide in narrative. In 1992, The Great Elephant Chase won the Smarties Prize and the Whitbread Children's Award. And The Demon Headmaster, perhaps one of Gillian's most popular stories for young children, has been serialised on radio and adapted as a play. So those are two short biographies of our writers here. What we're going to do is talk for about 50 minutes and invite you at certain times to put your questions or your comments to Michael and Gillian, and then there will be time afterwards for you to come down and talk to them and for them to sign copies of books if you would like to have a copy signed. So perhaps we could start, Gillian, with you, and I could ask you how you began writing, what your apprenticeship was.
I began when I was seven or so by writing books in exercise books, and whenever I got to the end of chapter one, I would read it and think, yeah, and tear it out and start a different chapter one. And then when I was about 28, I was bewailing to somebody the fact that I couldn't write. I said, everything I write sounds so stupid. And he said, of course it sounds stupid, because you wrote it yourself. You just have to ignore that. Which was the best piece of advice I've ever had, actually. So I then developed a style of writing by which I write the first three or four drafts of a book saying, it doesn't matter if this sounds stupid, because I'm going to go back and alter it later on. And so I wrote my first book in about 1974, and I then had a period of about 5 years when I was writing books and sending them off to publishers, and that was my hobby. they went away and they came back, and then I had more, and then it was really good. I really enjoyed it. And then one week in 1978, it can't have been quite 5 years, I actually had two books accepted by two different publishers, so that was a different kind of life after that.
Mm. But you've always had a feel for writing.
I've always liked writing, yes.
What about you, Michael? How did you begin?
I went to a very formal primary schools in the London suburbs, and the idea of writing anything other than doing exercises, you know, opposites, that sort of thing. They were very keen on opposites, weren't they, in the 50s. They thought that this, you know, if you could write bad next to the word good, that somehow or other this was a conceptual breakthrough and would lead you on to greater things in the London suburbs. Becoming a butcher poet, I don't know, but anyway. So really, yeah, there wasn't much writing around, apart from just sort of filling in these sheets of exercises. I seem to remember that first two, I went to two primary schools. There was one thing I did, that I wrote. My parents used to read The Daily Worker, which may mean something to you or not, as the case may be. This is because they were communists. They were Jewish communists, actually. I mean, they were parents as well, but I mean... I wrote a story for The Daily Worker, but in fact I didn't write a story. It was there was a picture book going around at school called Solomon the Cat, and I wrote a story. I wanted to write a story, and I called it Solomon the Cat. And in the picture book, it told the story of how a cat gets thrown out and goes from house to house asking for somewhere to be put up. And my story did the same. The cat looked for somewhere to be put up, and it got published in The Daily Worker. And Mum and Dad are very pleased with me. And then it got printed in the annual as well, the Christmas annual. So even communists do Christmas. And then sometime later, we got a letter. The school said, the paper said, actually, that we got a letter from the paper saying that they'd heard of a children's picture book about a cat called Solomon who gets thrown out and goes from house to house. And my dad picked up this letter and he said, "See this, Connie? See this? Someone's stolen Michael's story and made a book out of it." You know, the things that people do. Anyway, that was the first thing I didn't write. At secondary school, there was these things called essays and compositions. They had those, didn't they? They got quite interested in that. And I used to like that a lot. This was just at the moment when if you got an exciting essay title called Fog, you could actually write it as a sort of story, because up until then you had to just do it like a kind of Met Office report. But just at this moment was the bit where they changed and they allowed you. So I got quite into that. Started writing some poems when I was about 16. I sort of followed in the Solomon the Cat routine. I read D.H. Lawrence's poems, which you may remember they're called things like Bat, Elephant, and Snake. And I thought I'd write a poem like that, and I called mine Moth. And I couldn't think of anything to write about a moth, so I took D.H. Lawrence's poem Bat, and wherever it said bat, I scribbled that out and wrote in the word moth, which worked quite well, apart from one bit, which you may remember, where he uses the Italian word for bat, pipistrello, and I thought that's probably not the Italian word for moth, but I didn't know what the Italian was. So anyway, that got printed in the school magazine, actually, that one. So that was the second thing I didn't write. And so then, while I was at university, with my good friend Dick Hughes on the front row, and Jeremy, I wrote a play called Backbone that was actually stolen from my brother's life, actually, happened, so that was the third thing I didn't write. And that actually went on at the Royal Court, and then I started writing some poems that I thought were for adults about childhood, but there weren't any adults who were interested. And somebody said children might be interested, but of course you have to interest an adult in order to get through to a children's audience. So Faber's said that children don't like poems written from their point of view. And we had a great big think about A.A. Milne and Robert Louis Stevenson, those terribly unpopular children's poets. But anyway, that's what she said, the good lady there. And then in the end, Andre Deutsch took it up, a lady called Pam Royds, who took up a book of poems and married me to Quentin Blake. And that's how the first book of poems appeared.
Mm.
So anyway, a long career of not writing anything, of writing other people's poems. Anyway, you know what I mean.
Mm, okay. I'm really interested in getting into the whole notion of writing for children and choosing children as audience, rather than taking up a career writing for adults, and what that actually entails. Gillian, you said in an article in the School Librarian, and I quote, children's books are almost invariably written by adults, and writer and reader are never therefore interchangeable, never on an equal footing. And I'm sure that that's true. And I wondered if you could sort of explore that statement in relation to your stance as a writer for children, who offers a great deal of equality to the child reader.
I think the things it means for me, there are two important things it means for me. One is I'm never in danger of confusing my audience with myself, because I know I'm not a 13-year-old boy, or indeed a 13-year-old girl. And so I know that I have to make people understand me. And the other important thing is, I don't see how you can write for children and be tempted to show off. If you're 54, it's really quite difficult to show off to people who are 13, because there are things that, of course, you can do better than they can, and they just take that for granted. And all the other things, they assume that they can do better than you can anyway. So the effect of those two things, as far as I'm concerned, is simply to concentrate my mind on the story and take away a lot of the kind of lumber that would otherwise stop me. And I'm perfectly sure that one of the reasons I've never written for adults is simply that I'm completely intimidated by the whole idea of writing for adults, because actually I think they're so clever. And I don't think I could cope with that. Whereas children may be clever, but I know the issue of who knows most is just not an issue, because we know different things. So it takes away my problems.
Mm. Do you have specific children in mind as you write?
No, I don't think so. I just have a child. I envisage the person I'm writing for as somebody who's going to close the book any minute now, unless I'm very careful. I think that's my only concept of audience, really.
Yes. What about you, Ken?
Well, to start off with, as I was saying, I had no sense of a child audience. I thought that I was writing some poems in the voice of a child, but addressing them to an adult, which is a convention. It would sound pompous, but I mean, it's at the beginning of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the James Joyce, that in order to convey childhood, he wrote about childhood in the voice of a child. But I don't think he ever thought that kids would read the first 20 pages of Portrait of the Artist. There's that whole sermon in there that takes about a year to read anyway. But and somehow or other, I'd been greatly affected by that, and so I thought, well, that was a legitimate thing to be doing, to, as it were, addressing an adult in the voice of a child in order to try and explore some of the ironies or weirdnesses or strangenesses of childhood. But then I discovered that nobody, at least commercially, was interested in that, or in fact, even personally, really, no adult seemed to be at all interested in reading these things. So then what happened, because a children's editor took it up, and this is where institutionally it's quite interesting about the way in which literature works, is that in a sense, if you imagine literature as you're in various rooms, the rooms are interconnected, but there's no question you are in a room, and the room of children's literature is separate from that adult room, even if there are sliding doors between them. So then you're welcomed into this, I was welcomed into this thing called children's literature, which I had lost contact with since about the age of 11 or 12, so now I was about 25. And then suddenly something opened out. Suddenly there are people inviting you, like Good David here from Birmingham, Birmingham School. Suddenly I was being invited to Birmingham and go round schools. Or suddenly you're invited into a library, or suddenly there are reviews in these magazines that you'd never heard of. So suddenly you do realise there is this place, and a mixture of audience and mediation starts happening. You're aware that people are looking at what you're doing, and they're looking at it from the point of view of both contemporaneously as to what else is going on in kids' lit, but also historically. And I hadn't made any of these connections at this point. And the other thing is you arrive in front of an audience of children, which, I mean, I hadn't been in front of an audience of children, or been amongst children, since I had been a child. And suddenly I was standing in front of 200 kids and supposed to be doing something. And I remember one rather extraordinary encounter. I arrived at a school in West London called Princess Frederica, actually, would you believe, in Kensal Rise. And the guy, Sean McAlane, the deputy head, had invited me in, an Irish guy who did a lot of poetry work with the children. And he said, and he kind of ushered me in like I was a celebrity, which was a bit odd. As he said, now, here's Michael Rosen. See? And I remember kind of walking in thinking I was going to read to about 10 kids and read like this, you see? Like that. And I did. Well, you can't do that with London kids. They give you about 15 seconds, and then they turn to each other, and they start going, because it's all much more interesting than what you're doing. And I went like this, and I just glanced across to Sean, and he was just absolutely aghast. He thought, by reading the stuff that was in Mind Your Business, that I'd be some kind of lively bloke. But I thought, what you do about poetry was you go, and he went, he interrupted me, and he went, it doesn't go like that, does it, boys and girls? And they all suddenly kind of ka-chung, and went, no, like that. And then he then proceeded to recite one of the poems. He actually danced it. He jumped about, going, the ship in the dock, da, 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 he was waving like that. And then he handed it back to me and said, that's how it goes, isn't it, Michael? And then I mean, it was almost, you know, Road to Damascus or something. I made a connection between the fact that I'd done loads and loads of acting and performance and mucking around since the age of 11. I used to belong to an Amdram outfit, you know, in Ealing, and did loads and loads of acting stuff at university with Dick, amongst others, and Jeremy. Jeremy was Bottom, by the way, just want to let you in on that. And I was Robin Starveling. And all that, and I made the connection between the performance and the reading and the writing. But it was the fact that you suddenly discovered an audience. But, I mean, institutionally, that's actually quite clear. And the fact that what you write, whenever you write it, it's mediated, and there's an audience. And that audience is not entirely self-selecting. I mean, it's carefully created, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not, framed by radio, newspapers, magazines, and all that. And in fact, I mean, you can tease that out about children's literature and how it's managed to survive since its invention, say, end of the 17th century.
So you've got a clear sense of your audience, really, when you're writing. Do you think in terms of performance and how it will be received in that kind of way?
I think a mixture. Some of the stuff I can imagine myself performing, other stuff I can imagine parents and teachers performing, and other stuff I can imagine a child reading quietly on their own. So in fact I might have a sort of mixture of it, and sometimes I'm playing around with the child I was, sometimes with my own children as they've been, or alternatively children I've worked with in classrooms. So it's like a sort of fusion of all of it, I think. But some of it I do have a sense in which there are different reading situations. I mean, it's become clearer over the years that reading isn't some sort of abstract, finite quantity, but actually varies with the reading situation. You think about it, you know, if you read something on a holiday, it's different from reading it just after your mother's died. You know, reading situations change.
You both talked about childhood a little bit, and this is an area that's interesting because it's changing, just as children change. For example, if you look through God Help Us reading schemes that have, you know, proliferated in school right from 1900s onwards, really, and you look at the images of children as they're portrayed in reading schemes, we have very much the two-child family, middle-class family, up to about the 1950s, 1960s. Very obediently reading, I might say, you know, knowing, sort of, look, sitting in front of the fire, television off, reading. And now if you look in modern reading schemes, that image of the child reader is changing somewhat. There's no longer the two-child family. There are families in different situations. There are children from different ethnic groups. So this notion of the childhood world, even in the reader, is changing. And I just wondered, from your point of view as writers of real books for children, how you accommodated the nature of childhood and what it meant to you. Gillian, can I ask you?
Well, actually, I don't think my books are really about children at all. Not in the sense that Michael, I think, was talking about, of reflecting ideas about what childhood is, or memories of how it was different to be a child, or I think my stories are stories about people, and the protagonists are children, simply because that's how I'm able to tell the stories. So it's necessary for me to, I mean, there have to be sort of unrecognisable childhood situations, because I also write moderately realistic stories. But I'm not interested in the ironies of childhood, and, I mean, not as a writer. And I don't want, if people happen to clasp their brow and say, gosh, that's exactly what it's like being a child, that's fine, but that's not what the stories are about. So, oh, and the other thing about my life, which means that I suppose in a way I've never been reflective about children, is that Martin and I have actually got four children, and the youngest one's only 14, and we had the first one when we were 21. So I've been kind of submerged in children since I was 21. So I don't see them as being a separate category of human life that you need to think about. I just, in fact, have been rather bewildered from time to time that most adult fiction doesn't have them in, except as rather strange and subterranean creatures, because I can't really conceive of adult life, to be honest, without a lot of the people in it being children. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's the best I can do.
Let's just pause at this moment and ask if any of the audience would like to say anything about that or ask any questions. Yes.
This question is actually directed at Michael. I wanted to know if throughout the years you've had to resist the temptation to write about the adult experience as opposed to the experience as a child.
I've often written about the adult experience in the same way as Gillian's saying, is that because I've been around children since I was 30, not quite as young as Gillian. That's right, my firstborn was 76, that's right. That, of course, one aspect of adulthood is that you are engaging with children. It's just parenthood is seen as a separate category from adulthood in our culture, which is rather strange. I mean, because, you know, most adults are either parents or grandparents or even godparents or whatever. You know, they just are around. If you mean kind of adult experience without kids, I often do. It's just that, I mean, there is this rather peculiar thing that faces writers, is that some things sell and some things don't. I mean, I don't want to reduce it to that, but I mean, you could write steaming loads of stuff about something, but that may never actually see the light of day because nobody's particularly interested in it. So as a writer, you have to kind of face up to the fact that some of your writing is like a hobby and some of it is the stuff that people see. And all I can say is that, yes, I often write about my adult experience, but by and large, nobody in the place where people make books are particularly interested in buying it in order then to make a book out of it. I mean, this has got no regrets for me. It's just that, as it happens, I do. Do you see what I mean? So, I mean, I don't to make it seem crude, but I mean, in a sense, it would be the equivalent of someone working in, I don't know, in any walk of life, and they write and know that that stuff won't necessarily be seen. It just so happens that one of the walks of my life is writing for children, and another walk of my life is not writing for children, so I mean, it's writing this other stuff. On the changing childhood problem, I mean, it's one of those nice contradictions, isn't it, in the sense that, you know, children stay the same and children change. You know, they're both truisms, but in actual fact, you've got to try and hold both in your head at the same time. So, you know, a journalist, a snap thing, will see a child getting involved in Pokemon, say, and it appears like some brand new extraordinary phenomenon. You know, the child is playing Game Boy, watching the cartoon, playing the board game, collecting the Pokemon figures, talking in the Pokemon language, being utterly incomprehensible to adults. It all seems so terribly new and extraordinary. But then, you know, you can go back to when I was a child and there were other addictions and crazies of one sort or another. And in one sense, one aspect of it's new, or one aspect of it is extraordinary, which is that it seems so total. It seems like, you know, the multinational has got hold of the child as never before through, like, every known orifice almost. Do you know what I mean? Is that they've got the child buying and reading and watching, and it's all part of the same organisation, which you think, well, they didn't quite have that when we had the Eagle and the Beano, did they? There was the free gift, but it wasn't quite the same. On the other hand, the level of obsession, when you actually look at the child, in my case, my youngest, I mean, his level of obsession with it doesn't seem to be much different from my brother's obsession with bus numbers. And having to collect every Ian Allen bus number book there was and spending hours collecting the badges and filling in. So the obsession seems the same, but the actual penetration by the multinational seems slightly different. I mean, so in terms of that change and the same, I think you have to hold the two somehow in your head at the same time. Yeah. I mean, as a writer, you don't actually have to pay any attention. You take somebody like Nina Borden, and I've spoken to her when we used to do Treasure Islands, and her attitude was, well, I'm not actually that bothered, really, as to whether childhood is out there and it's changing or not. I know what I'm writing about. I'm writing about the deep mysteries and problems that I faced as a child, transmuted through various stories that I make up. And this is based partly on the mysteries and problems of my own childhood, but also others as I see as I go along. I'm not actually concerned with the immediate child out there. And that's why her books have such an incredible integrity and quality about them, because she knows she is on a certain wavelength and sticking to it. You don't have to be hopping around and wondering, oh my goodness me, I better write a Pokemon book. Well, I won't call it Pokemon, I'll call it Stokemon. And it'll just keep up in time. You don't have to be like that.
But although your writing's very different, you do actually write, both of you, about important issues to children, such as the relationship between adults and children, such as sibling rivalry, love, brutality, the tension between freedom and individuality, the nature of making difficult choices in your life are all there embedded in your work, I think. And I was reminded that Jacqueline Rose once wrote that there are three major issues that children are drawn to in their reading, which are origin, sex and death. And very little else than that matters. Do you agree with that? And if so, do you represent these themes in your books, say, Gillian?
Oh dear, this is going to sound so awful to say. Because it sounds so snooty, but I really don't represent themes in my books at all. And if I started out trying to represent themes in my books, it would just be death. I do is I get a kind of notion of how nice it would be if there were this book. And then I have to write the book to sort of find out what it was I wanted in the first place. And I couldn't write it unless it was about something that interested me. And of course, like anybody else, I dare say I find origins, sex and death extremely interesting. But whenever people start talking about themes in books, I always get terribly unhappy if I feel I have to make an input. I mean, I too have done a university English degree, and I know how you do these things. And I know that it's not in my interests as a writer to explore them in my work, because while I want to be critical about my work, I don't want to approach my work as if I were a critic, because then I wouldn't be able to do it. I try to write stories that I find interesting, that I think other people will find interesting too. And I think that however much people chew it over, we really don't actually understand how stories work. We don't understand why they're so important. We don't understand why they do what they do to people, or why they are extraordinarily, really, such a vehicle for exploring meaning on all kinds of levels and in all kinds of ways. And as soon as we start trying to put them in a straitjacket and define them, then they stop working. And that's why copying never works. It's because you've set yourself... You can't write it. I mean, nobody could write a good Stoke-on-Mon book because they'd have set themselves such a very narrow path to start with. So, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the question.
Well, we were looking at... I was suggesting that you both drew on major themes, really, that resonated for children, and that you said you didn't actually write... thematically or with that in mind.
Yes, I don't approach it like that.
You approach it as a
story. I wouldn't be at all surprised to find I'd written about things that I found were interesting.
Yes, yes. You said, Jeline, you might be prepared to tell us a little story at one point, and I wondered if this might be the time to...
Would you like me to tell you a story?
To do this.
Right. Once there was a young man whose father was dead, and he lived on the edge of a wood with his mother, who had no other children. And one day he went into the town to do some shopping, and he met a very beautiful young woman. And he took her home to meet his mother. And in due course, he decided that he wanted to marry this young woman. So he proposed to her. And the young woman said, "I think if you want me to marry you, you should give me a present. And what I really fancy," she said, "is that beautiful silver watch your mother wears around her neck. Give me your mother's silver watch." Well, now, he knew that his mother valued the silver watch very much because his father had given it to her. But he went home and he said, "Mother, I long to be married. I'm longing to be married. But she says she won't marry me unless I give her your silver watch." So the mother said, "My son, I want you to be happy. Take the silver watch and give it to her, and I will come and dance at your wedding." So off he went with the watch, and the young woman put it on and said, "Now we can be married." So they were married. And when they'd been married for a month, the young woman said, "That was a very fine silk dress that your mother wore to dance in at our wedding. I'd like to have your mother's silk dress." "Oh, you couldn't do that," said the son. It's the only good dress she has." But his wife moaned and groaned and fussed and flapped until finally he went off to his mother and he said, "My wife is so unhappy. She longs for your silk dress." So his mother said, "Take it, my son. If it will make her happy, that will make you happy." So off he went with the silk dress. And 6 months later, the wife said, "This is a very pokey house where we live. It's very small. It's not nearly as nice as your mother's house. I don't think I can go on living here any longer unless we have your mother's house. I'm going to leave you." And the young man was distraught. But she went on and on and on. And eventually, one evening, he went out to his mother's. And he sat there and he had a cup of tea and he sighed. And eventually his mother said, "Tell me what's the matter." "It's my wife," he said. "She says she'll leave you unless I have your house so that we can come and live in it." "It's all right, my son," his mother said. "Have my house." And she moved out of the house. And she went to live in the depths of the forest in a little wooden hut. And after that, things were quiet for a while, for a year. And then the wife grew more and more and more restless. And finally, she said to her husband, "I'm going to leave you unless you bring me your mother's heart." And he said, "I can't do that, you're mad." "I may be mad," she said, "but I shall leave you unless you come back this very day bringing me your mother's heart." So he went out and he walked in the forest and he walked up and down under the trees. And finally he went to his mother's house and he sat down and he didn't say anything. And his mother said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I don't know how to say this to you, Mother, but my wife says that she will leave me forever unless I take her your heart. And I don't know what to do because I love her so. I shall die if she leaves me." And the mother said, "I can see there's nothing to be done." And she picked up the kitchen knife and she said, "There you are. Do it now." And she closed her eyes and the son slit her chest open. And he cut out her heart and he took it in his hands. And it was getting very dark. It was nearly the end of the day. And he hadn't got long to get back. So he started to run back through the forest with the heart in his hands. And because it was dark, he tripped over the root of a tree. And he fell and he hit his head. And the heart went flying out of his hands. And it said, "Oh, my son, have you hurt yourself?"
Thank you very much. Thank you. Original Sex and Death. Michael, we have to follow that up with asking you, I think, if you could.
Yes, I find nearly everything that Jacqueline Rose writes unbelievably irritating. Because I don't think she cares a damn about kids' lit. I mean, that's the main problem, is that she's mostly used children's literature as a vehicle for some other purpose and then left it behind and got on with much more important things like psychoanalysis and things like that. But the moment you start making statements like that, you know that they're in a sense like kind of the agent provocateur. They're sort of meant not as a statement you're supposed to believe in, but a statement that you're supposed to be provoked by. And, you know, and anyone who opens children's lit and sees children at reading will know that the statement is obviously fallacious. I mean, they're interested in all sorts of things. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it may be that the things she says they're often interested in, or mostly, but I mean, they're interested in lots of things. You know, the clouds are sometimes quite interesting. You know what I mean? It's just sort of, I don't know why it is that the literary world seems to attract these kinds of dogmatic, totally unprovable, illogical statements that, you know, they just collapse inwardly on themselves the moment they're said, really. It's rather weird, but anyway. Anyway, as some possible illumination of the matter, I told you my parents were Jewish communists, and you may remember that the last government, which was so terribly different from the present one, used to come up with slogans that were supposed to illuminate our lives, one of which, stunningly, was the problem today is that parents don't teach their children the difference between right and wrong. You may remember that surfaced at one moment, and we all went away, obviously, and thought, wow, well, we better start doing that, because we had never done that before, had we, Gillian? So it was something that just never occurred to us. And so that was really helpful. And then, rather mysteriously, about a week later, they stopped saying it. You may remember, it was a real fly-by-night job, and it just completely disappeared, which may have had something to do with the fact that some of them got caught with their pants down, and some of them got caught with their fingers in the till, and we might have asked questions about their parents, I suppose. But anyway, never mind. But it did have one knock-on effect, which is I thought, did my Jewish communist parents tell me the difference between right and wrong? So here's another issue. I don't know if Jacqueline Rose would be interested in this. Of another thing that bothered me at one point, anyway. I nagged my mum and dad for a torch.
Oh, go on.
I'd love a torch. One of those ones with the black rubber around them. Oh, go on. Please.
So that night, I got into the bath
and went underwater swimming with it.
Breathe in, under the water, switch on, search for shipwrecks, treasure,
up, breathe, under again, exploring the ocean floor.
Then the torch went out. I shook it and banged it, but it wouldn't go. I couldn't get it to go again.
My birthday torch. So I got out, dried myself off, put on my pyjamas and went into the kitchen.
The torch, it's broken.
And my dad says, "What do you mean, it's broken? It couldn't have just broken. How did it break?"
"I don't know. It just went off." "I don't believe it. You ask him a simple question and you never get a simple answer.
You must have been doing something with it."
"No!
It just went off." "Just try telling the truth, will you? How did it break?" "I was underwater swimming with it." "Are you mad? When I said this torch is waterproof, I meant it keeps the rain off. I didn't mean you could go bloody deep sea diving with it." For weeks and weeks, he nags a stupid that he wants one of these waterproof torches, and the first thing he does is wreck it. Ruined. Completely ruined. How long did it last? How long did it? 2 minutes? 3 minutes? These things cost money, you know. Money. I felt so rotten. My birthday torch. At the weekend, he says, "We're going into Harrow to take the torch back." We walk into the shop. My dad goes up to the man at the counter. He says, "You see this torch? I bought it from you a couple of weeks ago. It's broken." So the man picks it up. "Couldn't have just broken," says the man. "How did it break?" And my dad says, "I don't know, it just went off." "Surely you must have been doing something with it." "No, no. No, it's just my dad, no. Just went off." "Oh, come on," says the man, "these torches don't just break down." So I said, "Well, actually, I was in," and I got a hard kick on the ankle from my dad. "I was in the..." "All right, yeah, I was in the kitchen, and it went off." So the man said he would take it out the back to show Len. He came back a few minutes later and said that Len couldn't get it to work either, so he would send it back to the makers. "You'll have to have a new one," he says. "I should think so too," says my dad. "Thank you." Outside the shop, my dad says to me, "What's the matter with you? Are you crazy? You were going to tell him all about your underwater swimming fandango, weren't you? Blabbermouth." Anyway, that was how I learned the difference between right and wrong. Anyway. So, whether that was origin, sex, or rock and roll, what was the third thing? Sorry. Drugs? No, I don't know. Anyway, whatever it was. Like children don't... You see, it's that kind of psycho model, isn't it? That you just live in a kind of weird dyad or triad with your parents. I mean, that's the model that Jacqueline Rose is working on. As if somehow or other we haven't got our bums parked in the world. We're only kind of parked in a family. I mean, that's the problem of the model that she's offering. And that somehow or other, you know, our parents and us, we don't go out, we don't leave the dyad and the triad, we don't go out and negotiate with the world, and the world doesn't reach into the family. And the problem with that model is that, I don't know, we wouldn't survive from one day to the next, would we? Because somebody has to go and get the bread, and somebody actually has to earn the money to buy the bread, and all that stuff has to happen, doesn't it? So, anyway, so...
Let's just pause again at that point and ask if anyone wants to say anything to Michael or Gillian, or ask anything to do with those issues.
Could I ask both of you about the idea that there's much less chance of an ethnicity when your children are all going to have grandparents, that because of the fact that our children can see so much and learn so much of things that innocent adults didn't know about a generation or two ago, their whole experience of childhood is drastically curtailed? Do you believe that?
Well, first, I think it's just a question of the bits are shaken up and something else has happened. You could argue that they have a much longer childhood than the little boy of two that they found down the coal mines opening the trap door when they did the report on the coal mines. or that they have a longer childhood than people at the beginning of this century who could leave school at 11 if they could pass the school leaving exam and then were grown up and went out to work. And I think there are major differences in all kinds of ways. There's the difference that you can't keep things away from children in the way that you used to be able to because of the nature of modern media. There's also the difference that it's true for lots of children that they know things that adults don't know or don't know very well anymore. I mean, it's easy enough to laugh about the fact that your children can program the video and maybe you can't. But the fact that there are a lot of technological things that clearly a lot of children can do better than their parents must actually change how they view the world. And it's no longer true that adults know all the things that you need to know. So in that sense, childhood's changed, I think. But in another sense, you have to go an awfully long way now before, unless you're one of these teenage millionaires from the internet, before you actually get any real responsibility. You can still only get married at 16 because nobody's worked out a way of making that a non-viable law. If they could put it up to 21, you bet they would, because that's the way things are going. You know, I'm always amazed, good, if we let them vote when they're 18, you know, that's much more the kind of tendency, it seems to me. Even if you're technically an adult at 18, you're somehow not grown up. We don't trust them in the way that I think children were trusted. Even when I was a child, my husband used to come home as an eight-year-old boy and light the fire, as a matter of course, and spend hours wandering around by himself. And there aren't many children nowadays, certainly not many middle-class children, who are allowed to do that because their parents are terrified. And so in lots of ways, childhood's become much more claustrophobic. It's only in certain ways, just a different combination of pieces, I think.
Yeah, I think the problem is if you talk about childhood and don't differentiate it, you immediately start running into problems, and you have to differentiate it sometimes by gender, sometimes by class, sometimes by location, sometimes by community, by cultural group or whatever. And the problem is the moment you start going for the generalisation, you're in shtuck, you're in trouble. So I think, in a sense, to answer the question, you have to put that kind of matrix over the word childhood and say, well, okay, let's talk about a specific group of children in a specific time. So if you say, well, let's have a look at, say, working class London children of the 1860s, well, we're talking here about the Dickens child, aren't we? Well, the Dickens child, I mean, obviously, relate how Dickens wrote about it with the actual conditions, say the Mayhew-type kids and what they're doing in Mayhew's London life. You could see these kids, they were trading, they were living off their own wits, they were sometimes street kids actually living on the streets in the way that is described, you know, in cities elsewhere in the world and that sort of thing. At the same time, if you say now, well, what about the well-off middle-class Victorian family? What is the child doing? And then we know there was the nursery and the sometimes the governess and sometimes the formal education system, boys being more educated than girls. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the differentiation is enormous across the centuries, across the cultures. So the problem when people ask that question is they're quite often relating possibly something like a middle-class child of the 50s and maybe a middle-class and a working-class child of the 90s. And that seems to be happening a lot of the time because quite often, say, just in the world of education, you know, if you just take an issue like literacy, and people say, with massive generalisations, oh, well, everybody could read in the 50s. Well, I mean, it's obviously such complete nonsense. There were kids leaving school, the school leaving age was 14. Many kids were actually getting out of school at 13. The secondary modern system is a complete disaster. And there were grammar school dropouts, my grammar school, that, you know, just were lost in the system. And yet people quite happily contrast the 50s as this sort of perfectly idyllic, all educated, all numerate, all literate lot, and then somehow or other the mass of whatever failures of today, leaving out the people who were totally excluded by the system in the 50s. You see what I mean? So it is very difficult. I think one has to always ask of the question, and I don't mean to throw it back at you, but to say, well, let's compare like with like on this. And obviously, to a certain extent, enormous securities have come in since, say, the 1860s. On the other hand, a lot of others. But on the business of knowledge and what kids know, I think, as Gillian said, I mean, you know, what did the 2 and 3 year old coal mining kid know? Well, you know, there's evidence that when the inspectors went in, one of the first things that appalled them was that, you know, the miners, men and women, were fornicating in the mines within the eyeshot of the children. That was one of the things they actually reported in the factory reports. My God, think of the morals of the children. They weren't actually worried the fact that they were working their asses off. It was just so much the morals. That was the bit that bothered them, because there were all kinds of disgusting chit-chatting going on down there, and smoking and drinking and all sorts of things. So, you know, those kids presumably knew quite a lot, quite apart from most of them dying by the time they were 20. I mean, the stats on it. So, very difficult to hold in your head. I mean, the historians of childhood, you know, moving to a more and more complex picture of it all, and any of the simplifications that appear in the national press on the matter are usually so glib and so silly, and it seems to be something to do with wanting to hold on to an ideal of the 50s. Well, those were there in the 50s, I mean, please, you know. Mm.
Could we just turn, finally, you mentioned education there, Michael, if we could just follow that theme a little bit and look at what's happening in schools today as we now talk, where those of you who are in education will know the literacy strategy is to the forefront in primary and more in secondary schools as well now, in year 7 and 8. And with it seems to have come a shift away from the child as a responder to literature towards the text itself. And to give you an example of what I mean, one of the people who's put this strategy together says, traditionally we haven't stayed with the text, and I think that's going to be the biggest shift for teachers. They've used wonderful literature and poems, but they haven't traditionally stayed with it. They've said, this character is frightened in this book, tell me about you being frightened, rather than looking again and again for evidence in the text. In other words, there's a shift back now from the child as a responder to analysing the text itself. And I wondered two things, really. First of all, how you viewed that in relation to your own work being used in school. And the second thing that accompanies that with the literacy hour, how you feel that perhaps small chunks of your work are being used in school without children perhaps having access to the whole of the work or having time to read the whole of the work. So, Gillian.
Well, I must confess, first of all, to not knowing a great deal about this. I do go into schools, but I don't usually have any particular connection with the literacy hour. And I certainly have never written a book ever and considered what use it might be to teachers or what bits of it might be any good for something, or it just is a kind of non-issue, really. I think the only thing that I can say that I've ever strongly thought about this issue altogether is that I very much distrust the idea that everything that happens to children must happen in schools. And it seemed to me from time to time that people have almost felt that children's reading had no meaning unless it issued in something that happened in schools, that the private reaction of the private reader somehow had to be turned into creative writing or some kind of criticism. Or I know that my children have always been readers and not so readers, as they are, completely impervious to the kind of thing that says, write down a review of every book that you read this term at home. And I think my only concern is that the sort of autonomous reading experience shan't be devalued somehow, shan't become something that happens in school. And I think the way out of that is not more things to happen in school, but it's actually, I think it's just adults to read. I think if adults just read and had fun and made it obvious to children that that's what they were doing, then it would be obvious that this is a part of adult life. But I'm always rather depressed when I go on the tube in London, which isn't very often, because although you see one or two people with a book, you don't see everybody with their nose stuck in a book, which seems to me one of the most sensible things you could do on the tube, really. And it's that kind of thing. So I'm not really straying from the question. I think what I'm saying is I don't think that's got a lot to do with reading, as reading means to me. And I don't actually think it's got a lot to do with writing, as writing means to me. It's just a different kind of way of looking at text. When I was an English student at Oxford, certainly nobody said to me, Othello is very jealous here. What does it mean to you to be jealous? They said, look at the text and tell me what's going on. And that was fine. I loved it. I adored it. It's just a different thing, I think. But as far as pulling bits out of my books goes, well, yes, why not? As long as they don't think it's the story.
Yes, Michael.
We've got a double question there. On the business of the shortened text, the problem is that the literacy hour seems to be predicated on the idea that something's going to improve. And they think that what's going to improve is that by drawing attention to what they think are the nature, what is the nature of a text, that somehow or other something called literacy will improve. And how will you test literacy? The answer is you will ask some of the questions that are, in a sense, already embedded in the kinds of stuff that's in the literacy hour. So it's a self-serving thing, you know, that if you teach a child 1 + 1 = 2, and then you say, what is 1 + 1? And the child says 2, then you've proved to some point or other. I've never understood what that point is, but that central notion in education that you lob a fact and then ask the child to repeat the fact, that then something called education has happened. That's the principle. And the literacy hour has got that embedded in it. Now, when it comes to the business of what we think of as two of the most important things that might emerge out of education would be continuous reading and continuous writing of any kind, we might think that's quite important for some kind of sustained reading of any kind. Might be manuals, might be football programs, it doesn't matter what it is as far as I'm concerned, but some kind of sustained engagement with a text on the reading front, but also the ability to write something for a little bit, for a while, on anything. Well, I can't see the link between the literacy hour and those two objectives. I can't see any link at all. All I can see is a link between writing shorter and shorter things or reading shorter and shorter things. I mean, I don't know whether you're aware, Gillian, but I mean, what's happening is your books are being torn up into little bits and turned into worksheets and the like in order to fit the hour. I mean, my stuff's short enough so that they don't have to tear it up. But the problem is that novels are getting torn up. Now, that wouldn't matter in itself because, after all, one aspect of looking at a text is to look at part of a text. Fine, fair enough. But then is there the space within the primary curriculum then to look at a whole novel? Because, after all, for the last 200 or 300 years, we've been having the idea that a novel has got a particular kind of relationship with consciousness, that it's got a way of turning over reality, of looking at it in a multifaceted sort of way, of holding one person still while you move another one, and then vice versa. All these things that we know about narrative and inside and outside and society and the individual, all those sorts of things that we think a novel can do, and yet it is the experience of many children in years 5 and 6 never to actually engage with this process in school. Given what you're saying about out of school, but even so, in school, that there's less and less of the idea that a teacher might read a book through from beginning to end because there isn't time. And anyway, there's this kind of suction whirlpool effect that the literacy hour is somehow the literature hour as well. That really teachers are saying, oh, well, I've done that. So I did a bit of Gillian Cross, so I've done Gillian Cross, so I've done that. And there might be some books in the classroom for you to read after you've been playing with the Lego or something. I mean, so that is a genuine problem, is that continuous reading has been reduced, and the same applies to the continuous writing. It's an incredible coincidence. What's happening is that over and over again, teachers are saying, well, you know, you now put down your pens or whatever it is that you're writing on. So the idea that, as you did, which was to write novels in your exercise book, all right, maybe you did it at home, well, you know, we know that in previous times, there were kids writing chapter books in schools, years 4, 5, and 6. They can't do that now because it doesn't fit within the writing objectives of the literacy hour. So there is another problem there. But overall, I mean, there's some other problems with this literacy strategy, which is, quite apart from anything else, I mean, it is an act of totalitarianism.
I mean, some people don't mind about totalitarianism. It doesn't seem to bother them as much as it bothers me. But, I mean, it is rather extraordinary that a document that's going to affect the daily working lives of well over 100,000 people and possibly millions of schoolchildren hasn't actually got an author's name on it. There's a committee that scarcely anybody knows who was on it. It defies all the criteria that all you folks have been through college and all the rest of it know, that every time you quote somebody, you've got to put the reference. And when you say research shows that, you know that, you know, Jeremy's going to put a line through it and go, whose research, where, when, date, you know, what are you doing? And this document says research shows that. That's what it says. Whose research? Why? Where? When? I mean, nothing is proven. So a whole document, again, is based on something that nobody knows what it's based on. I mean, it seems extraordinary. And then within it, there's a strategy vis-a-vis what they call grammar, which in actual fact is by and large sentence grammar, which is only one tiny aspect of how we put the language together, and it's written sentence grammar as opposed to the overall grammar of the language, which of course has to include the spoken language, that they think that somehow there's a relationship between teaching sentence grammar to 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10 year olds has some relationship with what they write. Well, they know from years of O-levels that there was no correlation between the grammar part of the paper and the continuous writing part. For 30 years, they've got the statistical evidence that there were hundreds and thousands of kids who could score 100% on the grammar and completely screw up on the composition, and vice versa. There is never any correlation between teaching sentence grammar and continuous writing. And yet the whole of the literacy hour is based on that, quite apart from the fact no one's ever asked the question as to whether it's possible to genuinely teach abstract sentence grammar to people under the age of about 9 or 10. I mean, you don't teach calculus to 7-year-olds. The reason why we don't teach calculus is because we say it's too high a level of abstraction. You know, this all that dy by dx stuff that I didn't understand when I was 16. So, you know, we don't teach it. So why is it that people assume that a level of abstraction about language, when if you say an orange, by and large kids start thinking about orange things and fruit things and things like that, and if you say, no, we mean a noun, kids get a little bit confused because it's a level of abstraction. This is not all kids, I'm just saying that, you know, kids under the age of about 9 or 10, because, you know, we do know that there is a developmental problem about abstraction. And yet that whole literacy strategy is predicated on a notion that you can teach that level of abstraction. Who says? Research shows that. Who are the people behind it? We don't know. That seems extraordinary. I don't know how they got away with it. I really don't. I mean, anyway, the jury's out on whether anything will happen, other than, of course, I think it'll be self-referentially proven to be successful, because they'll only ask the kinds of questions that come within the purview of the thing itself, which is an old dodge, and then they'll move the graph anyway, because like they did with the 11 plus for years, you know, as the women in the audience will know, you know, you had less of a chance of passing the 11 plus than we did because you were women. Hard luck. You know, 55% of you passed, 45% of us lot passed, but somehow miraculously 50% of both of us passed at the same time. So they just fudged it. They just moved the graph. Well, they do that with tests always. I mean, the whole history of testing and assessment in schools is that of a mass fudge. And they'll do that on this one as well, because otherwise Blunkett will lose his job.
The thing that actually concerns me from a reading point of view about that is not any of those things about which I couldn't possibly argue with you, but the fact that it worries me that there will be a generation of children growing up thinking that people like me and people like Michael write the stuff that we write so that teachers can use it for communicating grammar and sentence structure. I actually get letters from children, and I bet you do too, Michael, saying, where did you get your good words from? Or, your book was very good, but there was not enough hard words in it, or other educational comments. And I think I was quite old. When I say quite old, I mean I was a graduate and into a second degree before I really knew deep down that the writers who wrote what we are pleased to call the English classics actually wrote them for fun, because they had to, because they meant to entertain people. They did not write them, actually, to provide grist for university English students to exercise their critical skills on. I mean, I knew that, but I hadn't felt it to be true till I was really quite old. But at least I had this whole area of fiction and poetry and so on that my school curriculum didn't touch, that I knew was written for fun. I'm a bit worried sometimes that modern children don't get that. That they think, unless they happen to be very predisposed towards writing, that they think all writing is just part of the them. It's part of the them that does things to them, and what you do when you grow up is to do something completely different. If they have teachers who really enjoy reading books and enjoy writing, I don't think they will grow up like that. But nevertheless, that's why I try not to look at the idea of people hacking bits out of my books and using them for things. It's not that I'm worried about my sacred text, because really, you know, it's not that great. But I don't like to be misunderstood, and I feel that probably happens a lot.
Hmm. I'm going to have to, in a minute, draw the session to an end, when we obviously could go on a lot longer. But I would like to ask you both, just before we stop this formal part of the session, what you're actually working on now.
This afternoon, I was working on a picture book, Life of Shakespeare. I went to Walker Books some time ago and said, well, isn't it a shame there isn't a very accessible Life of Shakespeare? Not because anybody knows anything about the life, because they've got little tiny bits of it, but just a sense that this person did live in a particular place and time, or two places if you like, Stratford and London, and actually belonged in a certain milieu, or several milieu, being the son of a tradesman down the road from here, and then joining this new gang of people in the theatre world and owning theatres and all that, and then becoming quite rich and successful, and then finally dying. And that a sense that person and time and place existed behind the plays, and the plays aren't these strange, abstract, floaty things that are about all things for all people at all times, but in actual fact did belong in a place and time. I thought that's quite a stiff challenge for myself, and so I've suggested writing something like this, fairly short, only a few thousand words, and with very, they call it hyper-realism anyway, that sort of very dense picture book illustration, very social realist sort of representation of London and Stratford and the theatres and all that. And they've bit on it. The only problem was I'm about a year overdue with the deadline. But they're very patient. And I used the English department's computer this afternoon between sessions in order to try and finish it. I didn't quite succeed. But anyway, so that's exactly at this very moment what I'm writing on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've got it on disk in there. So anyway, there you go.
Well, I am not quite a year over with Michael. I'm about 8 months. But unlike Michael, I'm not going to tell you anything about it at all. I regularly get asked this question by children, and I'm forced to say to them what I say to you. But if I tell you about the book that I'm engaged in writing, it will sound so incredibly stupid to me that I shall never be able to finish it at all. I have no problem at all about people reading a book when I've finished with it. But until I have finished with it, I'm still at the stage of saying to myself, yeah, I know this is incredibly stupid, but actually I can still change it. And so I'm very sorry, I'm not going to tell you.
That's very interesting. Michael and Gillian, thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you.